attack on March 7th, 2020, at the age of 84. The complete 50-minute interview with Mark Crowley can be found as a Bay Area Theater podcast in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org. I'm Rich Wolinsky on Bookwaves.
Bookwaves is produced by Richard Wolinsky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to an encore episode of Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm S.W. Conser. This week, we've set the Wayback Machine to July of 2010, when radical professor, author, and Weather Underground co-founder Bill Ayers came to town. Bill had just published a comics version of his book, To Teach, with the help of illustrator and co-writer Ryan Alexander Tanner. Ryan had been invited to stay at the Chicago home of Bill and his wife Bernadine Dorn during the long writing process. This all took place during the 2008 political campaign of Barack Obama, and there weren't many moments when Bill, Bernadine, or Ryan could step outside the house without being followed around by amateur videographers who were all hoping to record an unguarded moment that might land them on Fox News. While you're enjoying this vintage interview, we'd like to encourage you to take a moment, go online, and support community radio at kboo.fm. And now, Bill Ayers and Ryan Alexander Tanner, recorded in Portland, July 2010. Welcome to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and Bill Dodge, my co-host, is on the engineering mic right now. Our guests today are the authors of To Teach, The Journey in Comics. Bill Ayers, the Distinguished Professor of Education at the University of Illinois in Chicago, and back for the second time, Portland cartoonist Ryan Alexander Tanner, now cooling his heels in Brooklyn, was the illustrator of this book. Welcome to you both.
Hi. Thank you. But let me just correct one thing. Ryan was not just the illustrator, he was the co-author. And so while he did the pictures, he and I wrote this together. Even though it's based on a book I did 15 years ago, it's actually a brand new book. And Ryan was really instrumental in bringing the whole thing together, story, pictures, text, everything.
Now, the original book, To Teach, The Journey of a Teacher, that was intended for young teachers coming first into the field?
Well, it was a book that I wrote about my own understanding of what teaching could be, the kind of intellectual and ethical dimensions of teaching. And I wrote it, I don't know, 15 years ago, I believe. And it got picked up by teacher education courses all over the country, became a pretty big book for this publisher. And so they asked me to do a second edition, which I did. And when they came to me to do a third edition, I was so bored at the idea that I kind of flippantly said, you know, I'll do a third edition if you let me make it a comic book. And I thought that would be the end of it. And I'll be darned. They came back 2 months later and said, it's a great idea. Let's do it. And then we went on a search for an artist, a collaborator. And very lucky, I found Ryan Alexander Tanner right here in Portland. And we collaborated for better part of a year, but he lived in Chicago with us for 6 months.
Yeah, so Ryan, what was it like to move from Portland into the town home of the notorious Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn?
Well, I'll tell you something about Bill that you might not have heard on Fox News, which is that he's a nurturing gentleman. So for me, it was almost like moving back in with your parents, but it's less shameful because they're not your parents. And it's he called it my artist in residence, which was a very nice way of putting it. But Bill fed me, and he taught me how to drive, and he took me to all this stuff. And I was sort of absorbing his whole kind of vibe and the way he talks and presents himself so I could do it visually. So it was, for me, just, you know, kind of profound, benevolent experience. And then the contrast between that and obviously what was happening in the larger media world was it was surreal for me, to say the least.
And, well, let's get this out of the way right off the bat. Bill, so are you the Svengali behind Barack Obama's rise to power?
Yes.
Okay.
Just wanted to check on that.
Yeah, so you've checked it. It's true.
He had all these chickens. He was always cutting up these chickens, and he was draining their blood into this tub. And I said, "What are you doing, Bill?" He said, "This is going to get us Ohio." So,
you know, the truth is that I also found the experience surreal. I did know the president back before he was a senator, and we were indeed guys around the neighborhood. I mean, it's a small neighborhood, and so we did know each other in that way. And like millions and millions of people, I really wish I knew him better now. And I wish he did consult me every Monday morning, but the fact is he doesn't, and, you know, that's something in the past.
Well, you were working on a couple of foundations together. One of them was the Chicago Annenberg Challenge, if I've got that right, and also the Woods Fund for poverty alleviation. So pretty much everybody in that realm of Chicago politics, it's all meet and greet anyway, right?
Well, we know, you know, it's a small town in some level, just like Portland. We know one another. And it's true, we were on boards together. But what that meant is that we, you know, that we worked together on a project, but it didn't mean that we were like palling around in the sense of sharing a milkshake with two straws or, you know, something like that.
Now, much was made of Barack and Michelle coming over to your house when you and Bernadine had a party at one point.
Yeah, well, we did a fundraiser for them, and there were moments like that. But one of the really sad things about that whole period is that on the one hand, the demonization of me and Reverend Jeremiah Wright and Rashid Khalidi, the great scholar, Palestinian scholar, that was bad. But worse than that was the idea that if somebody associates with somebody else, shares a conversation or a boardroom, that they somehow are responsible for one another's politics, policies, background. That's absurd. And actually, in a wild and woolly democracy like this, it should be a great strength, not a sin, to associate with all kinds of people, to speak to all kinds of people, and at the end of the day, to have a mind of your own. And President Obama certainly is that person.
Mm-hmm. So, Ryan, if you had one story to sum up your days of working on the book in the Ayers-Dorn household.
You want the election angle? Because I have an anecdote.
I think our listeners want to hear all of the juicy stuff.
Okay, well, this was for me sort of the defining moment of what this was like in my experience was Bill and I were going to watch The Daily Show.
And this is back in 2008 when you're living
I think it was actually a Cubs game, actually, we were going to watch. And so we're flipping through channels, and there was some news station or other as we're flipping through channels, and there's a picture of Bill right there, and it says, you know, unrepentant terrorist. He was, you know, having sex with Obama and advising his campaign. And I sort of look over, and there's Bill, and he's in his pajamas, and he's eating a watermelon, and he's the most non-threatening person I've ever seen, you know, and he had just taken me out to dinner, and he gave me my dream job, you know, and I looked at him, and I said, "That's you." And it is him, but it's not him at the same time. And another thing I say is that for me, creating this book was a great opportunity. This is something I hadn't planned. There was no Obama campaign when I signed on to do this book. This was something that came out of left field for me. But one thing I say is that this little cartoon representation of Bill was for me sort of an opportunity to get to share with an audience the person I got to know and I experienced, which was something that happened in real life. And I sort of say the cartoon character we created is much more accurate than the cartoon character Fox News created.
Uh-huh. You're listening to Words and Pictures on KBOO. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and I'm here with the authors of To Teach, The Journey in Comics, Bill Ayers and Ryan Alexander Tanner. Bill Ayers is the Distinguished Professor of Education at the University of Illinois Chicago, and Ryan Alexander Tanner is an up-and-coming young cartoonist living in Brooklyn, used to live in Portland, mm-hmm. Second time here on the show. So, Bill, another book that you wrote recently that our listeners might be familiar with is Fugitive Days. Mm-hmm. And this is a look back at your leadership in Students for a Democratic Society and later the Weather Underground. And you, in fact, married your wife, Bernadine Dorn, back in the days when you were both underground.
That's true.
Obviously, there's a lot of people who look back, and even left-wing people will say that wasn't the right time to take the war home, as you put it. You didn't have the majority of Americans on your side.
Well, you know, first of all, I say the book Fugitive Days, which was published on 9/11/2001, that was its pub date. And it got a kind of rocky opening, rocky beginning, but it's now 10 years later, and the book's done pretty well. I am fiending for the book to become a comic book. but I mean, it's so visual. It really is a visual book, and it in fact, I was telling Ryan, I was just in Germany and Switzerland because the German edition of Fugitive Days just came out. And the way they presented the book tour wasn't at all like I'm used to, where you kind of sit in an easy chair and talk into a microphone. They had a very well-known rap artist from Switzerland rap 20 minutes of the book into a microphone, kind of screaming, performing with visuals and music, and it was incredible. And it really gave the book a different feel. But I'm going to go back to this question of the Weather Underground and the question of where we were. And I'll say it very briefly, but the fact is that I was first arrested at opposing the war in Vietnam in 1965.
You're still a student in Ann Arbor, right?
I was a student in Ann Arbor. 39 of us were arrested. We had 300 or 400 supporters, and we were surrounded by 2,000 students who wanted us arrested, beaten up, expelled from school. Because it's hard to remember in retrospect that even though we have all this mythology of the 60s, overwhelming majority of people supported the war in 1965. 3 years later, a majority had come to oppose the war, and there's lots of reasons for that which we could talk about. But because 6,000 people a week were being killed, it was a crisis for democracy and a crisis for the anti-war movement. And the anti-war movement splintered. And frankly, I did many, many things, most notoriously the Weather Underground. Within my own family, people joined the Democratic Party and tried to build a peace wing. People ran away to the communes of Vermont. People went to Europe. People organized, you know, the working class. And we did what we did. And frankly, nothing in Fugitive Days defends what we did as brilliant and forward-looking and wonderful. It tries to explain why this young man from this privileged background, set down in that historical landscape, did the things he did. And that's all it attempts to do. It's a memoir, not a manifesto.
Now, it's interesting you say privileged background, because you've been, a lot of your coming up in the education world has been working in low-income neighborhoods, what are called underperforming schools, but places that needed a shot in the arm. But you could have had a pretty cushy life. Your dad, Thomas, was CEO at one point of Commonwealth Edison, the big utility in Illinois.
For a long point, for 30 years, yeah.
But yeah, one of the things that Fox News was complaining about, they were putting forward this idea that you and Bernadine got off easy on all the federal and state charges because your dad was a powerful and influential figure in Chicago politics and philanthropy. And you have to wonder, okay, so Fox News guys, you don't like when powerful dads help out their misfit kids or what?
Well, there is that. And I you know, the truth is that I had a very, very privileged upbringing, and I went to prep school and I went to college and I was supported by a very generous family. That's all true. The reason that we got off, however, from the Weather Underground is actually a little bit different than that. For one thing, the crimes that we were charged with were all dropped. So I was charged with two conspiracies, one to cross state lines to destroy government property, and one to cross state lines to incite civil unrest.
And this was having to do with the Pentagon and Capitol bombings.
Those things and other things. But the fact is that those indictments came down in 1970, and by 1974, when Watergate happened and the kind of truth came out about things like COINTELPRO and FBI surveillance and so on, it turned out the FBI had a written plan to kidnap my nephew to get Bernadine to turn herself in. And J. Edgar Hoover had signed off on that plan. So this was one step too far. And that moment is the moment when all charges against us were dropped, when the country wanted to simply move on. But the truth is that part of the reason that we didn't face the harshest kinds of punishment is that no one was ever killed in what we did. So at the same time that I was killing no one, actually John McCain, John Kerry, many others were killing people. John Kerry himself said in front of the Senate that we commit war crimes in Vietnam every day, not as a matter of choice, but as a matter of policy. And that's true. We did not commit those kinds of crimes, and we tried to end that madness. And we did it in a way that many people find, as I say, despicable. Now, it's been resurrected, of course, that history. And frankly, the Weather Underground is better known today than it ever was when it existed. And that's got to do with the media, with presidential politics, with a lot of things that are, you know, hard for me to determine or understand.
Well, looking through your book, To Teach, The Journey in Comics, the book that you two worked on together, it's clear that, your theories about education are progressive. They're not about teaching to the test. They're not about No Child Left Behind. At the same time, you were advising Richie Daley, the mayor of Chicago, about school reform, and you two seem to have very different approaches.
What that school reform was about really wasn't about the classroom per se. It was about a radical decentralization of this heavily bureaucratized urban system and putting power in the hands of the communities and the parents. And that's what I worked with Daley on. And that was, I think, a roaring success. But it doesn't quite get us to the classroom. And you're right. You look back 40 years ago or you look back last year. The classroom is always a contested space. The school and the question of what the school should be is always contested. And the reason that's true is because school represents the possibility of a future different from today. And so we fight out in the school questions of what does it mean to be human? What do we want for our children? What should the world look like? What's fair? What's just? And these issues are always going to be fought out. So I'm not looking forward to a day when the school wars will end. The school fight will be an ongoing struggle over our future, over the question of what we want to see ourselves become. So the crisis that we're facing right now is also a great opportunity. And it's an opportunity where a book like this actually could make a difference in the sense that we begin to think of education not so much as training, not so much as finding your place on the hierarchy of winners and losers, but really education as something that transforms people so that they can ask the hard questions and take control of their own lives.
Well, let's talk about the book here. It's the book is To Teach, The Journey in Comics. The authors are William Ayers and Ryan Alexander Tanner. Well, let's talk about the process of turning your textbook into a comic book. Now, Bill, you brought in Ryan. What were you expecting when Ryan arrived at your
house?
That's
a good question.
Yeah, I think what I was expecting was that he would come and illustrate a book I'd already written, and that was my expectation. So I was thinking I wouldn't have that much to do. Ryan would draw what I wrote, and it took him about 2 months to tutor me. We read Scott McCloud together. We read Paul Auster, and then tell me again.
Paul Auster wrote City of Glass, and Paul Karasik and David Mazzucchelli did the comics version. And to me, we've been compared a lot to Understanding Comics, which is fair, I think, because really, at this point, if you're trying to make a guidebook to something in comics form, you would have to sort of willfully dodge Understanding Comics to not be influenced by it, because it is a very definitive and very successful way of conveying ideas in that form, especially sort of large abstract ideas.
One of the things I remember Ryan saying to the publisher early on when we were first working on the proposal, they had originally the idea of doing a shorter kind of floppy,
yeah.
And Ryan said, I want the comic book to be as layered and dense and filled with these ideas represented differently.
I don't want it to be a supplement to the book. I want it to be equal on equal. I want it to be an alternative to the book.
Right. And it's not like you would read the comic book and then enter into the world of teaching and then pick up the real book. Just like a lot of people talk about comics as if it's an interesting introduction to real literature. And what Ryan was explaining to the publisher right from the beginning is this is real. This is a medium that has the potential to carry some very dense ideas in an emotional and direct form. And I think that's what Ryan accomplished.
One thing they sent me too early on was like, you know, Marx for beginners and Freud for beginners. And I have nothing, you know, bad to say about those books. I think they're very successful at doing what they do. But one thing just sort of inherently bothered me is, why is the visual one for beginners? I don't want to make To Teach for beginners. I don't want to suggest that. But the other thing is that those are more sort of like, here's a stream of text and then an image to sort of supplement. And I just told them right away, that's just not what I do. I'm a, you know, hoity-toity sounding sequential artist or whatever. You know, I'm a comic book artist. I draw comic books. So if you want panels and sequences describing events and conveying ideas, and that's what I'm bringing to this.
Well, the rule of thumb is show, don't tell.
That
like
was our
films.
Mantra on this book.
Yeah, he must have said it 100,000 times, but it took me a long time to kind of get what we were up to in our little silly introduction.
Well, I think, Bill, if we wrote a one-page thing together now, I would still say I need two panels of text, and you'd write me four typed pages.
Exactly, because, and you know, again and again, Conch, what happened is that he would give me an assignment. Like, we had this chapter, Building an Environment for Learning, and, you know, you work through the whole chapter, and at the end, there's this kind of marvelous image of an environment for learning. And
do you want to read a passage here?
No, what I wanted to say is that
he's
I wrote
the page with no,
what I
no
wrote
passage.
Was 6 pages
uh-huh.
of text.
Oh.
And Ryan rendered it as a single panel. But if you look at
without
panel,
any text at all,
yeah.
with no text,
and what it is it's a schematic of a classroom,
mm-hmm.
Your ideal version of what a learning environment should be.
Exactly for these kids in this particular novel. But what's amazing to me is you could study this page, this schematic, and you could study it over and over and over again, and new things would emerge, just as if you read my text, right? But it's delivered in a different medium. It comes at you at a different emotional level. Comes at you with a directness that I think is powerful.
Well, and throughout this chapter, we're building this space. We're starting with other spaces and just sort of saying, what do these spaces say? And what does any given space tell you just by the way it's set up and the construction of it? And then we're sort of looking at the administrative ideal of a classroom and then moving towards our own classroom. And so we kind of are building these ideas and talking about all these things we want to see within the space. And then at the end, I think it would be redundant to restate what we're showing you. I think at this point it's most powerful just to show you the space and let it speak for itself.
Yeah, well, looking through some of the chapters in To Teach the Journey in Comics, you know, if I was an up-and-coming teacher, I'm not sure if I would be encouraged or frightened by some of the stories that you have in the book.
Well, Bill, that was an important thing to you, and that's something we do right away is you dismantle these myths of teaching, right? I mean, it's not... The point of this book, I think it's a very sort of hopeful and progressive approach towards teaching, but it's not sugarcoating it at the same time, you know? It sounds so corny, I guess, but you teach out of love, right? Love of doing that and that work, and that's the same can be said of the approach to illustrating this book and writing this book, and I think that's something more than anything that I hope comes through is that this is two people who really cared about this project and weren't concerned about money and being promoted rather than creating this book for the right reasons and with the right tone and intentions.
I do hope that the message of the book inspires folks to want to do it. But as Ryan said, there's no sugarcoating. I mean, I speak at universities virtually every week, and I often ask audiences who are going to be teachers, how many of you think you're going to get rich as a teacher? And they all laugh derisively. And I say, good, I don't have to begin back that far. And how many of you have been told not to teach by a loved one, by a parent or a partner or a sister or a brother? And virtually everyone has been told not to teach. So I say, well, what's wrong with you? Why are you going to teach in spite of that? And the fact is that this is the kind of book those kinds of folks are looking for. A book that says, no, it's not easy. Yes, it's an intellectual challenge, but it's also ethical work. And there's very little that you can look at in this world, in this society, and say, I'm doing work that is profoundly intellectually challenging. It's profoundly ethical and moral work. Its implications for the lives of others are huge. And this book gives you a little bit of a guidance into how to hold on to that dream, even in the harsh reality that you will find yourselves in.
So what was the thing that led you into teaching originally? Was it a political act, social act? Was it just a love of knowledge itself?
Well, I began teaching in 1965. I was arrested in this first arrest against the Vietnam War, and I found myself in jail for 10 days with people who had started a small freedom school. And I went out of jail and into my first teaching job. I had no intention to be a teacher, but I was captivated by the place. In my own mind, from that moment until this, teaching has been linked to the idea of social justice, the idea of a better world. It's not true for everybody, and it's certainly not automatic. But for me, that link is very, very strong and very powerful, and it still acts on me. So I went into a freedom school, the idea being that we were going to create a model school for the kind of society we wanted to live in, a free society, a society of racial justice and economic justice, a society of nonviolence and peace, and that's the school that I worked in from 1965 to 68.
Yeah, in the book you express doubts not just about the overly bureaucratic school, but also about the freedom schools that you originally worked with in the early days.
Well, I mean, in many ways, I mean, I think in order to stay alive as a teacher or even as an engaged citizen, you have to be both critical and hopeful. You have to live with one foot in the world as it is, but one foot kind of striving towards a more ideal world that could be, but is not yet. And I think that, you know, part of being alive in your mind is being willing to be critical of your own, you know, actions and your own work. And so, yes, I look back at the Freedom Schools. They still are a touchstone for me of a good way to do things. But I also think they were excessive in certain ways, that they were immature in certain ways. Why not? They were being run by 20-year-olds, you know. But mostly I look back in those schools as a source of inspiration and hope.
Yeah, one of the things you put in the book here is that the teacher and the student are learning things together, and in fact, that shouldn't be a scary proposition. Teachers shouldn't get defensive if they don't know everything.
Yeah, I think the image on the cover is very indicative of that. It's sort of the fundamental image of the book, which is be a student of your students. You were learning together at once. So on the cover, we have Bill teaching the kid in one panel, and then the next, the kid teaching him, and sort of showing that lack of hierarchy or that contrast between those two things. And again, that's something where I think comic books can best show you, if you want to call it sequential art, but whatever, sequences of panels can sort of best convey this idea. That's all I got.
Well, but the theme really is, as you said, be a student of your students, mm-hmm. and unlock the wisdom in the room. And what I liked about the cover that Ryan came up with is that it really, in a very simple way, with two panels next to each other, shows you the way in which student and teacher can begin to collaborate, rather than think that one has all the knowledge and one is simply the receiver of wisdom. It's not that way. And good teachers are always finding ways to unlock the wisdom in the room. So several people have said that this iconic image looks like Ryan.
But this character, sort of the root of this character, is his...
The character of Bill,
is
young
his,
Bill.
His arrest photo.
That is.
It's the famous mugshot.
Yeah, he really took the mugshot.
Yeah.
And that mustache is definitely from the mugshot.
Yeah.
That was one cocky-looking mugshot
when
you were brought in.
I know, it was cocky-looking. And, you know, one of the things about... Who knew that would last for 45 years? Yeah. But, you know, when you're arrested and you're alone in a room and you've just been roughed up and it's you and the police photographer, you kind of put on a face like, you know what, buddy? F you. And that was kind of the face I had. My head was cocked. I had, my eyebrows were arched. If I'd been given the camera the finger, it would have been complete.
So Ryan, let's talk about your slideshow, your little promotional slideshow with Bill.
Sure.
At Floating World Comics. And one of your successful projects here in town, here in Portland,
mm-hmm.
was the illustrations for Dave's Killer Bread, this boutique bread line.
And one thing I really want to say about Dave Dahl and Dave's Killer Bread that should be known is that before they got really big, when I got in on the ground with them, they didn't have a lot of money to pay me, and they always said, that's not the one thing, that's the preface to the one thing, you know, they said, one day, well, if we get bigger, we'll remember you. And and that happened with Dave's Killer Bread, and they've stuck by me, and Dave Dahl is my friend and someone I always have a really good time working with and collaborating with, and that to me is just a huge show of integrity that's hard to find now. And Dave's a real person, and he's very much about appreciating the people that have gotten him where he is.
So, Ryan, what's next for you? You're going back to Brooklyn.
Well, yeah, I live in Brooklyn. Well, I just finished the Dave's Killer Bread coloring book maybe 3 weeks ago, and I think I'm seeing it for the first time tonight. But that's a great question. I'm sort of in, I don't want to say I'm in crisis right now, but I'm definitely in flux where I don't have...
Do you have something online?
I'm doing portrait commissions for very cheap. Unbelievably cheap portrait commissions on Etsy. It's you can find it on ohyesverynice.com is my website.
Say that slowly.
ohyesverynice.com, ohyesverynice.com is my website, which was just redesigned. So I'm pushing stuff through my website.
I want to offer you to do Fugitive Days in
comics.
We want
to do Fugitive Days, yeah, and I think that'll happen sooner or later. But.
Yeah.
Well, the book is To Teach, The Journey in Comics, William Ayers and Ryan Alexander Tanner, and a foreword by Jonathan Kozel,
mm-hmm.
who wrote Savage Inequalities, among other books. So Bill Ayers, how can our listeners find out more about this book and maybe even get themselves a copy?
Well, I don't know exactly. Maybe Ryan can help me. It's available locally, yes?
It's at Floating World Comics. I'm assuming it's at Powell's.
I'm sure it is.
You can buy it online. You can buy it at TC Press, or you can buy it on Amazon if you want. They tell us not to say that, but you can buy it there.
And Teachers College Press is tcpress.com.
Yeah, buy it at tcpress.com or at Floating World or possibly Powell's.
Great.
Well, Bill Ayers and Ryan Alexander Tanner, thanks for stopping by Words and Pictures. It's always a pleasure. Come back anytime.
Thank you very much. Sure. A real pleasure.
And stay tuned for an afternoon of music on KBOO.
Check this out, y'all. Read a book, read a book, read a book. Read a book, read a book, read a book. Read a book, read a book, read a book. Read a book, read a book, read a book.
You've been listening to an encore episode of Words and Pictures, recorded in July of 2010 and featuring Bill Ayers and Ryan Alexander Tanner. I'm S.W. Conser. Before we go, I'd like to remind you that your community radio needs your support more than ever. To become a member of KBOO or to arrange for a donation of any size, please visit kboo.fm.
Listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7.